Welcome everybody to today's webinar. Great to have everybody here. Now, don't you like my lovely screensaver I've got going here? Tell you what we're going to do today. Today I want to talk about some of the most commonly asked questions that I get. Now, I've actually got some friends to come along and help me with that as well, because we're actually in Adelaide at the moment, the beautiful Adelaide. And I have the lawyers and I have the accountants here, and it's all one big happy family. So I thought we could get on and ask all of the questions that we get asked all the time. And I thought that'd be a great thing to do for today's webinar. Now, first of all, I want to thank everybody who came along to the I Love Real Estate Super Conference the weekend before, on the Gold Coast. It was fabulous. We had so much fun. And I'm going to be doing a little bit of an update on some of the amazing things that we learned in maybe the next webinar or maybe the one after that. But there was some amazing stuff that we went through. We had the leading economist in Australia come and speak. And I think it's actually worthwhile doing a bit of an economic update on what he had to say about all of the major capital cities, as well as some of the mining areas and that sort of thing. It's also we also had some amazing inspirational speakers to speak. We had some of the student success stories, which were really incredible. What I did there is I picked students from a lot of different backgrounds, ones from that started with some money, some that started with very little money, and ones that did commercial, and ones that did construction and subdivisions and all sorts of different strategies. So you can really see it doesn't really matter what the strategy is. It's a matter of what suits you and how you consistently. I think the big message out of the I Love Real Estate is consistency. You know, consistent determination. Get out there and make it happen, and make it happen over and over and over and over again. So there was a lot of fun, a lot of parties. I gave away a lot of gifts, iPads, iPods, computers, all the rest of it. Anyway, enough of that. Let me introduce the team that I've got here. First of all, I've got Calvin. How are you, Calvin?
I'm great, didn't I?
How are you finding Adelaide?
Cold.
Oh, rubbish. It's not that cold.
And windy.
Just because you're used to rainy Sunshine Coast.
Absolutely.
I have Ian.
G'day, everyone. How are you going?
Very good. And I have Tasha.
Hello. How are you?
Very good. In a little while, we're going to have Derek. He's coming to talk about wills and other things with us as well. Now, you might just excuse me for a minute because Ian is going to get in and change over the slides for me, because we've got them on a stick and it wasn't actually working the way that we thought it was going to work. So we've just got to change over the slides there. Now, who are we starting with, Ian?
We're going to start with Calvin and the team and a couple of questions. So I've put together a couple of questions on what they do and the professionals, and some common questions that normally get asked of them.
Now, just before we do that, we better talk about their new announcements.
Yes, we're going to get to that a little after a few of the questions we'll get
all
to
right.
them.
We'll do some questions first.
Yeah, so, all right, Pacific Law. We've got Calvin here and Derek here. Hi, Derek.
Hello.
Where you been?
I was just looking out the window.
It's okay. Calvin, who is Pacific Law?
Well, Pacific Law, I hope you all know us by now, but, you know, we're a group of lawyers, a firm of lawyers based in Queensland in the beautiful Sunshine Coast. We've got a team of the three directors, myself, which most of you will know, Derek, which all of you should know, and David, that is the other partner that you all see in the conferences. There's the three of us, and we've got a team behind us with a couple of lawyers on the Sunshine Coast, and our support, which includes staff that run our conveyancing and other admin staff. There's about 10, 11 of us in the Sunshine Coast that we work out of, and the work that we currently are involved in is all the property stuff, and Derek deals with the trusts and the wills. David, in our office, generally handles the joint ventures, options, and development. We also have Michael in our office.
Michael handles a lot of the joint venture work as well, very experienced property lawyer, and so is Tracy, who's another member of our property law team.
Yeah, so I moved over to Pacific Law a few years ago now, and I can tell you how easy it is to have to deal with them. You know, David's been fantastic with his contracting. Calvin's always there to help out with the contracts and any property purchasing and also business stuff that we've been doing there. And Derek's been fantastic in making sure that when I'm dead, everything's okay. I highly recommend their usage. Obviously, they've got the office on the Sunshine Coast, and you've got people around the country, which we'll talk about very soon. So looking at a few of the other questions, when it comes to – do you want to add anything else before then?
Look, when you generally ring us or have queries about the contracts, you will generally get me or Tracy, who is a great help for us, and she's a very experienced lawyer, and she will run through, our template, I guess, of the general questions that we generally get out of these the property deals that you're encountering. So we have this team around us that will give you great support.
Right. So when it comes to structures, some of the common questions, and this is probably more for you, Derek, do I need to understand every bit of a trust structure?
It's imperative that everybody reads every single clause in their trust deed and understands them perfectly from beginning to end. In all seriousness, it's great when people show an interest in the trust deed and read through it. That is really important. But the reality is that trusts are a very complex area of law, and the document itself can deal with some very complex issues that deal with areas of law that are pretty tricky for lawyers and accountants to deal with as well. And so it's not imperative that you understand every single clause of a trust deed. It is important to understand the concepts of a trust, which is an important part of the establishment process, understanding the roles, what you can do with the trust, and how you're supposed to administer it properly. Those things are important, but the actual trust deed itself, to an extent, you're putting faith in the people that are preparing it for you. In the same way, perhaps, that when you have a medical problem, if you go to a doctor, they might not give you a complete understanding of the particular illness, as long as you're comfortable that you have an appropriate level of understanding and know what direction you're heading in, that's probably the key.
Yeah, and that's a great analogy. For me, I can definitely say that when, I had to see Dimpner talk about that trust structure probably 10, 15 times before I had some grasp and understanding and knowledge of what was going on. And now, my questions to Dimpner are a lot more complex, and to Derek as well, a lot more complex when it comes to the trust structures. So that will come with time. All you need to know and understand is the basic principles of why you've got the trust structures in there. And I mean, that's generally an asset protection thing, isn't it?
Absolutely. The concept of trust, I often say to people, it comes over you in waves. You get this exposure to trusts, and it washes over you in waves, and it might take a few waves before you have that blissful feeling of euphoria when you're drowning.
Okay, so when we first start and we've decided that, yes, we do need trust structures and we want to move forward, what are the basic structures that we're going to need to be market ready?
The usual circumstances are that people are setting up a discretionary trust for the investment in property with a corporate trustee as a core investment unit or an investment pod. It's not always the case that that's the right vehicle. Sometimes it's a company directly and sometimes it's a unit trust, as people may have had exposure to before. But generally speaking, it's that company as trustee for a discretionary trust that we're looking at, with the shares in the company that's acting as trustee being held in the piggy bank trust. That's the essential structure that we're usually setting up for people when they start their property investments.
So we've got two structures. We've got a piggy bank trust. And we've also got a trust, corporate trustee with trust that's going to be purchasing the property.
That's right. They're very different in terms of their uses. We have a protected structure in the piggy bank trust. So that's a one-off setup. You only set up one piggy bank trust usually. It sits off to the side and then will take a central role of control in a number of structures and then the company and discretionary trust for investment purposes.
One of the questions I always get is, particularly if students go and take the structures to an outside accountant or lawyer that doesn't really understand the complexity of everything, and they say, you know, the piggy bank trust has got to have a company on top.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. We get that a lot with people saying, well, you're setting up a trust, it has to have a company on there. And the simple fact is the reason we put a company in there is to minimise your personal exposure to risk for investment structures, because the trustee of a trust can be held completely liable for the activities of a trust. So where it's investing, we want to put a company in there to separate you personally from that potential liability. But the way we use a piggy bank trust keeps it completely separated from risk. So it's okay to have a personal trustee. There's not going to be any risk coming home to that trustee of that trust. So that's one of the outside questions we get about piggy bank trusts, along with accountants' comments of why are you setting this up? It doesn't make you any money.
Yes.
But of course, our friendly accountants within the structure know exactly, within the network know exactly what it's for. It's an asset protection vehicle.
Another question which also happened to us was because I had used someone outside and, you know, not really listening to what Dimna had to say, I had my trust set up outside and the shares of the corporate trustee for the properties were in Christine and I's name. And we were a bit freaked out because, you know, we had to move them across. We didn't know how much it was going to cost and whatever. Is that a hard process?
It's not necessarily a hard process to correct a structure by transferring the shares into the piggy bank trust. In some states of Australia, there could be stamp duty consequences of transferring the shares if you're not careful with how it's done. And so sometimes it's a matter of leaving those shares in the way they're held, you know, personal names if they've been set up incorrectly, and then waiting perhaps for that particular trust to sell its properties before we transfer the shares across, or maybe accepting that it's not the ultimate best structure to have established, but accepting that from now on we'll get it right. But it's certainly preferable to have those shares in a piggy bank trust if we can manage that.
We know with our ones to transfer them across, because of the states, was relatively easy for us.
Yes.
So someone comes to you, Derek, and they say, we don't know where to start, we don't know what to do. What are some of the things and information that you need to know about them as far as what they're trying to achieve in property and also their business as they start right now?
Well, it's an interesting issue because trusts are a complex concept. But the people that we're dealing with mostly don't necessarily have much of an exposure to it in the past because it's obviously not something that people deal with day to day. So as part of the setup process, the people that are setting up your trust for you should be running through your personal circumstances, you know, taking details about your family, who's important to you, what stage of life they're at, what exposures to risk they have, whether they have risky occupations like doctors and builders, whether anybody's about to go through a divorce, whether anybody's ill, that sort of thing in terms of personal details. And also knowing where your assets are held, what structures you might already have in place, whether you run a business, whether you're employed, all these sorts of things are relevant going into it. So we ask about those sorts of issues. Then we obviously talk about what you're looking to do into the future. And so generally, of course, for people listening, it's property investment. The type of investment, the state you're investing in, these are all relevant, and by state of investment, I mean state of Australia rather than state of panic or something like that. So it's a relevant question as well. And then we talk through with people the various roles within the structure, the directors, the shareholders, appointors of trusts, primary beneficiaries, all of those roles. We talk through who should hold those roles now, and also, of course, it's relevant who would hold those roles if something happened to you, for example, incapacity or death, something like that.
So one of the things there too also was when I first joined Dimna, I was running my own plumbing business on the side while I was teaching, and I was a sole trader. So you could also look at that part of their structure as well, making sure that they're correctly structured and protected, because now I've got our machinery separated from our company and all the rest that goes with that.
Yeah, there's always questions that arise about existing assets and protecting existing assets and what can be done. And so we run through the various options as part of that process of, do we transfer assets away into trusts, or do we set up contract of will, or do we try and create some friendly debt or protection through debt? Those issues always come up. And also structuring existing businesses where, you know, you could have, for example, people owning businesses and vehicles and investment properties within one structure, which is something that comes up quite often, and whether we can do anything about restructuring circumstances where a business might be owned and both husband and wife are director, where they might not need to be, and from a risk point of view, it might be advantageous to remove one of them from that role. So restructuring is something that always comes up as part of that process as well.
All right, some students come into the program having already bought property set up in their own trusts by, you know, people in the past, and then not sure whether they're Bamford compliant. So firstly, what's Bamford compliant, and can you trust? Can you look at their trust deeds?
Absolutely. Reviewing trust deeds is a really important step when people haven't necessarily got confidence in the way their trusts have been set up, or they've been set up a long time in the past. And the Bamford issue that you're alluding to is a case that occurred about 3 years ago, which changed the field a little bit for trusts and mean that trust deeds have to be checked if they were established before that to make sure that they've got the right terms to carry on into the future. But even basic issues come up all the time in trust reviews, like whether the right people have control now, who takes over control in the future, like I was saying, and even little basic options or issues like whether the trust has the ability to borrow money or invest in property. Sometimes trust deeds lack these fundamental issues that you know, the people listening to this are going to need into the future as well.
Okay, great. So I think we move on here now. We're talking now about having found properties, looking for properties. We've decided we're ready to purchase. We've spoken to Derek. He set us up. We're all great. We're going great guns, and we're out looking. And, of course, we go and find a property. And I've seen students that have signed contracts without having I've actually been involved myself in recent times where we've negotiated on a deal and the agent comes to me and says, here's the contract, let's sign it. And I'm saying, oh, no, hang on, I don't let anyone in my presence sign anything until my lawyer's seen it. Process for you, Calvin, when once the student has found a property.
Well, thanks for that, Ian. Look, interestingly, you will get a lot of pressure from agents that will try and get you to sign up ASAP because that is their job, and you need to recognize that. Now, someone like Ian or Dipner will have, I guess, the...
You keep going.
Yep, the courage, the experience to say no. Sometimes you do need to say no to them and just pause them. And the excuse that I would say to you is that your lawyer needs to review it before you sign up. Now, the reason for it is so that we can pick up issues for you before you are committed to a contract. Because generally we find the ones that are signed up before we get to it are the ones that will have the most problems. And the problems have the impact that you could lose deposits, you could sign up to a point where you become bound before you need to be, you are committed before we get to tell you about the things you need to know about, especially when you are not experienced enough in this process, excuse me, to, I guess, figure out what you need to put into those contracts. So generally, when you ask me the question, when should I come and see you, Calvin? I would say if you're not experienced, you should see me. Excuse me.
Got chili stuck in your throat.
Yeah,
too much Thai for you.
Too much time. Come and see us before.
Yeah, so you've got a couple of times. For you, you might say, for Dimna, for example, you have great confidence in Dimna. She's worked with you for nearly 20 years. And you have great confidence in the fact that if she's looking at contracts and whatever, she may call you and say there's a few clauses here, whatever. Like you're talking about an extremely experienced property investor, whereas for me, I'm still comfortable going to you without, I don't want to sign a contract without you looking at it. That's a definite for me.
Yeah.
Though I might get to contract stage and put it in front of you. For someone who's never done it before, you're saying, really, we should be talking right from the beginning.
Look, even sometimes people get to us before they've even found the contract, and they ring us up to say, look, Calvin, we're looking to do certain things. We do talk, maybe even at that time, talk them through a process of, you know, what they should be looking out for so that they are prepared in their minds when they go and negotiate the contracts, what should be put in them.
Yeah, okay. So also for a seller, all states are going to be different too. So as a seller, In New South Wales, you can't put a property on the market until you've got a contract.
Yep.
So I have to go and see you guys to set something up for me.
Correct.
Other states are different, though.
Yep.
So you really need to know, and that's where you can help them out. If depending on what state, they give you a call, you can help them out with that.
Absolutely.
What are some of the conditional clauses, leaving New South Wales aside, what are the conditional clauses that you like to see in the contracts?
Look, the ones that we really like to see are the ones that are dealing with typically the building and pests and the finance clauses. Now, these are some of the ones that people can get tripped up because they seem very common all the time. But and because they seem common, people overlook details that we will see that, you know, sometimes, again, it just commits them before they need to be. And also getting timing right for these clauses.
Okay, I do have a couple questions here, and this one's regarding joint venturing. I'm entering into a joint venture acting as money partner with another DIPMA student who has contract drawn up by Pacific Law. Is it appropriate to ask Pacific Law to act on my behalf and review the contract? I think we've got a fairly clear-cut answer here, and because this issue's come up with us before, your suggestion is, no, get another person to look at it.
Yeah, look, that's actually a really good question when there's joint ventures involved, because as lawyers, we can only act for the client and we have to be very clear who the client is so that there's no conflicts of interest in place. Now, I guess our preferred position is that we act for one party, but we also can act for the joint venture as a whole. And the separate interests of the joint venture partners, we may say, look, we're acting for the joint venture, but with each of your own individual interests, you may need to get your own independent lawyers to look at it so that we are not conflicted and we can carry out your instructions.
Probably a Derek question here. If we buy a single title lot, build a duplex and then strata title lot, do we need to set up these duplex in a separate trust? What would the time frame of setting an additional trust take? Well, probably more of a new question, because at that point in time, once you've set up, you've bought something in one trust, once you've built a duplex on it and want to strata title it, you're going to end up with two properties in the trust. Is that correct?
That's right.
And then to move that one of those properties to a separate trust,
it's
going to be a contract of sale.
Yes.
Yep.
That's correct.
So a contract of sale on a brand new building is going to mean that they're going to pay GST and?
And there'll be business, it'll be business income, so there'll be income tax on that as well.
Or capital gains,
yeah. Depending on the deal.
It's probably appropriate to talk right now. I mean, I know you've got, what is it, five of us here talking on the webinar, so it's a little bit confusing for everybody. But something that's probably appropriate to talk about here, particularly for construction and developing, and that is special purpose vehicles, where let's say Ian and I get together and we're going to go and build a duplex, and at the end of it, Ian wants one and I want one. How can we do that, guys? What are you, Derek?
There are ways, and depending on the state that you're in, you know, New South Wales has partitioning provisions which allow people to purchase properties in the proportion that they end up with it after they're transferred out to individuals and potentially not pay stamp duty. And what I mean by that is you might be 50-50 in the ownership of one title at the beginning, and then you can transfer it out half each at the end and perhaps not pay much stamp duty, because you're only paying stamp duty on the difference between what you owned at the beginning and what you own at the end. But there, sometimes your options are limited. If you want to start in a structure and then separate out ownership of the final product into different people's names, because you're essentially changing ownership, which means that you're going to have those stamp duty and capital gains tax issues. And sometimes it's just a matter of being simpler to sell them, or accepting that you're owning it together at the end, or that you might be paying stamp duty or capital gains tax on transfers.
And maybe GST, or depending on what the deal is as well.
Sure.
Yeah, and so essentially, if you've already, even if the property's in your own name and you're going to subdivide, you're still going to have to move it across to a structure, and if you move it across, you're going to have capital gains, possibly GST, and stamp duty to pay. We'll keep on going. New South Wales, Calvin, different contracting law to the rest of the country.
Yeah, look, New South Wales is unique in that sense, and whether that's good or bad, that's the way it is. And the process in New South Wales is all about the exchange, and at the point of exchange, it's unconditional. And until you exchange, as a buyer, you run the risk that the seller can deal with other people. So that sort of makes the whole negotiation of contracts a little bit more tricky. But again, this is all about the experience of dealing with these properties and finding the people around you that I guess they can work around all these things.
Yeah, I mean, coming from New South Wales, I do know when I'm working with New South Wales students, because they'll go to other states and they'll start negotiating on a deal, and then they'll want to do all their due diligence, and then they'll start talking about making an offer and putting a contract in, and by that time they've done. Because they're used to New South Wales, where you have to do all this work. In New South Wales, you could pay for building inspections and do all this sort of stuff, and then someone else can go and buy it under your nose. And the opposite can happen. For someone that goes to New South Wales, they'll put a contract on it, and you've probably seen it,
yeah,
where they just expect that they can pull out on an unconditional clause, which doesn't exist.
Correct. Look, I guess, you know, if you all have heard me in the three-day events, I do tend to say, and highlight that, you know, if you're used to dealing with property in your state, you can't take that knowledge and think you can apply it in other states, especially if you're looking at purchasing, let's say if you're from New South Wales, purchasing in Victoria or Queensland or WA, and thinking the same process works everywhere else, because it doesn't. And it's those little differences that are going to trip you up. So, you know, going back to the question, when should you see us? It's like, look, if you don't know, you're unsure, have a chat with us about it.
Okay, we'll move on. Now, you do have, because we get a lot of, we've obviously got students, yeah, across the country.
Right.
So you had a few, you know, you've opened up a new office, obviously.
Yeah, look, because of the demand, I guess, and, you know, thanks very much to you guys that are out there. And we're listening and we're responding, I guess, to your requests of, you know, do we have an office in New South Wales? So guess what? Because so many of you have asked, we've opened up an office in New South Wales, in North Sydney. We've got a very senior lawyer out of there. His name is Andrew Kleeman. He's, again, specifically just a property lawyer, and his past experience, he's dealt in high-end sort of stuff. In property development, strata titling, subdivisions, so anything property related in New South Wales, you know, there's not many things that will get past him. Andrew's details, are these slides?
Yeah, no, this is a pre-recorded, this is a recorded webinar, so they'll be up and running.
Right.
So anyone can go and post
I'll
there.
Just mention it is in North Sydney. His number is 02946028 71. Email andrew@pacificlaw.com.au.
So for all of your staff, you know, there's a questionnaire about options. You can do options. You can do any property transaction, because let's face it, when it comes to outside the box style deals, and I think I might have missed a page here.
Any out of the box deals? Look, I would say we would be able to handle 99.99%.
And that would be because?
That would be because we've got the biggest jack in the box. We actually call it the dipner in the box deal. So, yes, I think we're confident in dealing with out-of-the-box deals.
Yeah, so, and I do know that, you know, I'm outside the box too. And when I've taken stuff to them, you know, I know they can handle it. And Calvin... You know, Kevin and I, the other side's lawyer can always be a difficult party.
Absolutely. Sorry when I say, you know, and obviously I'm saying tongue in cheek, yeah, you know, Dipna, but, you know, Ian's getting up there too.
One thing I have noticed, though, is I noticed that with most lawyers in the past that I've used, they butt heads. It's about, you know, one trying to get one up on the other. And I found that with Pacific Law, and when I've dealt with you, Calvin, and you've had to deal with the other side, it's normally a education process for the other lawyer.
Look, thanks for that, Ian. And it really is, you know, I see my role as you want the deal. My job is to look after you and try and get the deal. So for me, it's not about my ego and showing how clever I am to the other side. Hey, if I have to look stupid to the other side and get the deal done, no problems.
Okay, so that's good. And I know, like I said, I can grant for the fact that Calvin has done that in the past for me and continues to do it. So it's very good. So other states?
Look, with the other states, you know, we've just been to WA. And we also understand and respond to, I guess, the conditions there. I know with WA, they like to deal with settlement agents, and it's very rare that lawyers in that sense are dealing with the actual settlement. So we do have our own settlement agents that are common there handling matters. But again, under, I guess, overseeing eye about it, and also, you know, the add-on value that we put on, which is reviewing the contracts prior to sign up, which we do in W and all the other states. Again, in Victoria, we've got our contacts there as well that, again, work very, very closely with us and are affiliated with us.
Great. Of course, I've got a question about how much does it cost to review our trust structures and properties and all the rest of it, Derek?
When it comes to reviewing trusts, existing trusts, we charge fixed fees to have a look at the usual sorts of things that people want us to look at. And there's a review that I call a key features review, which is probably the most common one that I do, where I look at a trust deed and make sure that control is held by the right people, that it passes to the right people, that the trust deed itself has the right powers to enable the trust to undertake the investments that clients want to do, and that they can distribute to related entities and that sort of thing. And that's a review that I charge $385 for a trust. With advice on existing structures and potential restructuring and that sort of thing, generally speaking, we're having a 20-minute conversation or a 40-minute conversation or an hours-long conversation in the process of establishing trusts and companies, which is considered part of that process. So there's no additional fee. It's part of what we do when we're looking to set up companies and trusts for people. But it's difficult to be too specific on those costs because people's circumstances vary so widely.
So contact you and you can give them, yeah. They can give you an understanding of what they're asking for and you
Absolutely.
Can give them a rough price. So that's one of the things I've also know that you're quite fixed with your pricing when it comes to certain parts of the legal process.
Yeah, look, this is where, you know, responding to our market is that, you know, everyone wants certainty with costings, and we get all of that. And where we can, we do like to fix costs for people so they do get that certainty, but also recognizing that, you know, deals can sort of go sideways, upwards, downwards, and that certain parts we may have to charge on an hourly rate, and we sometimes have blended fees, which is a component that is fixed and a component that may be a bit variable. But even when it's variable, we will give you some indication of, you know, where we think it will end.
There's no surprises with costs.
Yeah.
You're not up for a cost before you know it.
What sort of loan-style documents do we need to set up to move money between investment structures? That's probably a question that I get asked a lot too. You're lending money, obviously, from one structure to the other or from yourself personally. What are the forms of documentation that you can set up, Derek?
It's a very good question, and it varies depending on the amount of money that we're talking about. And so there's things like deeds of gift for a gift of money or loan agreements that we prepare for people. But the amount of documentation you go to depends on the amount of money. The reason we're entering into documents is usually for two main reasons. Firstly, to give accountants something to base their calculations on, but secondly, to prove the transaction. And so it might be that somebody's scrutinising the transaction in years to come and you want to prove that it actually happened. So for a start, it's obviously important that actually money moves around when, in the way that we're saying that it did when it comes to a gift or a loan. The transactions have to be real, but the documents have to be able to withstand the scrutiny. And so for what I say to people is that a small amount of money, you might be comfortable with a note or a minute of the trustee, for example, which just reflects the amount of money that's moving, the terms on which it's moving, any interest rate, when it has to be repaid, that sort of thing. So a note or a minute might be sufficient for smaller amounts of money. The money gets larger, you might find it worthwhile paying to have a loan agreement or a deed of gift prepared by a lawyer because you want to make sure it's a little bit more robust and able to withstand scrutiny. And for even larger amounts of money when it's a loan, then of course it becomes a question of whether security is required, whether you want a mortgage or a caveat or something like that to help support the borrowing to make sure that it's protected as much as possible.
Great. So we've got a comment here from Jared who says, after using Pacific Law and other firms, I really do appreciate the clarity around fees with Pacific Law and the surprises that it does avoid. So that's good feedback for you too. Can you define small, medium, and large, please?
I'm small. nobody's sleeping in next, are they volunteering to be medium?
No, medium.
it's a good question. The reason I leave it vague is it varies. I've literally had, for example, a client say, I'm loaning $100,000. It's extremely important to me. I want this documented to the nth degree. And I've had clients say, it's only $100,000. I'm not too concerned about it. I'd love to be in that position.
Yeah, right. So yeah, it's open-ended on that one. To open a trust, do you need to three generation?
We're talking about the beneficiaries of trusts and who can receive distributions. So that's what that question is alluding to and making sure that there's...
Yeah, no, you don't have to have three generations alive. But it just, as soon as you put yourself down, there's three generations that are affected by it.
That's right. A lot of people, in terms of beneficiaries, sometimes want to name their parents, grandparents, children, grandchildren all into the trust deed. And we try not to specifically name those people because then issues come up about them having to provide guarantees to the banks for borrowings if they're named specifically. Trust deeds define a broad range of beneficiaries by reference to how they are related to our primary beneficiary. So they don't have to be specifically named.
Okay, great. So moving on, we've got the beautiful Tasha here from an Investor Accounting Network, which is an unbelievably fantastic acronym, the IAN. You've got offices across the country, which we'll talk about soon.
Yep.
What does the IAN do? You do all of these things listed here.
That kind of puts me off. So obviously as accountants we do the obvious things like tax returns, bookkeeping. Probably the non-obvious things for the property people are things like advising about GST and capital gains on certain property transactions. The worst things we see is when someone's done a transaction during the year and comes to us to get their tax done, and they've sold a property that they've just bought and had no idea there was GST on that. And they've just had to hand, you know, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 to the ATO. So we also do things like set up self-managed super funds and do the ongoing compliance for super as well. And we do that in conjunction with Clint, who runs the Investor Advisory Network, which is another IAN.
Another IAN?
Yeah.
Geez, they're everywhere, these IANs. And they're all very annoying too. Just going on again. So if when the students come across to you, do you need to meet them face-to-face? Is it something that we have to do?
No way.
So
absolutely
you
not.
Can do online, Skype,
yep.
Email, the whole lot.
Absolutely. And this is probably something people sometimes get really, really caught up on, that they need to see their accountants, you know, face-to-face. But in reality, we have clients that live around the corner from us that we may never see. You know, it is something that can most of the time be handled, you know, via a phone call or via email or Skype, if that's what you prefer, or even FaceTime.
Yeah, I mean, that's the same thing with Pacific Law. I literally live, you know, 10 minutes from them, and the only reason I go into the office is so that I can spend time with Calvin because I like him a lot. My accountant is really good, and I say that in inverted commas, and says I do not need a trust.
Yeah, we get this comment a lot, and I guess the confusion around that is they think, well, all the accountants did the same degree, so why is my accountant saying something different to what you are? And while we did all do the same degree, unfortunately, the tax law doesn't stay static, and it constantly changes, and there's new rulings every day, every week. So, you know, unless your accountant actually specialises in this field, they're probably being left behind a little bit and still think, you know, negative gearing is the way to go and you shouldn't have a trust. And I guess the thing with a trust too, people have to understand the primary purpose is asset protection.
Mm.
So, you know, and people do get really hung up on this question about, well, but I won't get the tax deduction for it. I guess my argument is, well, tax deduction's no good if you're going to lose the whole asset.
I'm not sure whether we'll be able to answer here. What is the best structure for long-term buy and hold for capital growth? Is there a way to benefit from the negative gearing against personal income, which may happen in the beginning phase of investment? So I presume he's talking about you set up a trust structure, it's negative geared technically while they're doing the development and manufacturing growth, and they want to offset that against their own income.
You just can't.
You can't do it.
No.
Does the loss stay within the trust?
It does stay within the trust until there's income either from that trust or one of the other trusts that you have. You can actually transfer a profit from one trust into another trust that's made a loss and soak that up.
So the loss would stay in there, and let's say it was where we're forgetting at other structures. If there's a loss within that trust and finally a year down the track it makes some money, that money will then be offset against that.
Absolutely. You don't ever lose that loss. It carries forward indefinitely.
For a long while. I've decided, so, and I'll just make a comment about my accountant. It took me 2 years because my accountant was so good, you know, I thought he was really great at what he did and whatever, and it took me 2 years to realize that in the end all I was doing was educating him. So the plumber was educating the accountant on accounting, and so in the end I moved, and it was so far, it was so much easier to have to deal with someone that knew and understood Dimpner. You know, they spoke that language and go around with that. So that suggestion's a good thing. Move across if you can. So
I started a new language.
Yeah,
now.
There's a new language. It's Dimpner.
Dimpnese.
It's Dimpnese.
It doesn't sound
good. Okay, so I have decided that I need to switch accountants and move to the Investor Accounting Network. How do I do this?
It's actually a really, really simple process, and people are quite fearful of this and what it means and, you know, are they going to lose all that history that they've got with their accountant? I guess from our point of view, the first step is discussing with the client whether they want to let their accountant know or they want us to. Sometimes people want to make that phone call and let their accountant know they feel like moving. Other times they're more than happy for us to handle it. And from a, I guess from the legal point of view, we have to send a letter to the previous accountant letting them know that we're now taking over, and also requesting any records that are relevant. So you don't lose all that history when you move to another accountant.
Yeah, and they don't have to physically go to their accountant and say, I'm leaving
no,
you.
No, they don't have to if they don't want to.
No, you can do
not.
All the to-ing and fro-ing, and it's a common thing done in the industry.
It is.
It's done with super, it's done with accounting, yeah. It's done with bookkeeping.
And it's an absolute professional courtesy.
And also done with the legal people as well.
It is.
Correct? If you've got new clients.
That's right. Yeah. It's a relatively easy process to move across, and you know, people aren't having to confront people about leaving them. Obviously, they can if they want to as well.
I might come back to that question there. Okay, self-managed super funds. Are you qualified to talk about this?
I have an exemption for another couple of years, yes.
Okay. the common question, how much do I need to be able to start a self-managed super fund? How much do I need in super fund?
I guess it depends on who you're asking. So a lot of the, you know, the ATO and the big corporates will say 200,000, and basically that's based on the fact that self-managed super funds can be, I won't say expensive, that's the wrong word, but I mean there are costs in running a self-managed super fund. You have to prepare a tax return, which is the equivalent of doing a business tax return. It's not an individual tax return, and it has to be audited. So while you can start a super fund for a lot less than that, you just have to be happy that those costs are going to have to come out regardless of what your balance is. So, and it also depends very much on your strategy as well. You know, if you know that there's a property or something you want to do with a less balance, as long as you've considered that and received advice, there's no issue around that at all.
So, you know, I see a lot of properties, and, you know, you can get into a property for somewhere, the deposit, you know, and still have a little bit in reserve, but somewhere between $50,000 to $100,000. It's not going to be a dear property. It's going to be a regional property or a, you know, an outskirts of the city kind of property. But if that property is going to make you more than your managed fund is now and still cover the cost, well, I think it's worth it. But, you know, it's your call, and you've got to remember that there are the smaller amounts of money, the percentage of costs you're going to be paying on a year-by-year basis is going to be a little bit higher. But, you know, that's something you can, if you're making more, well, who cares?
Yeah, I mean,
my opinion.
The thing with super is you just have to you know, you really have to consider it and get advice about what you're going to do. And if that's part of your strategy, there's no issue. There's no ruling or law out there saying you can't set up a super fund with as little as you want to.
Right. Can I buy a residential property? Sorry, I work for the government and I want to start my own self-managed super fund. Can I do that?
You can. The rules actually changed around this about 1 or 2 years ago. Up until then, you could not roll over government super into a self-managed super fund. And this actually applies with a lot of the big mining companies as well, not just government employees. Now you can. A lot of them require that you leave a balance in that super fund because they want to pay into the super fund that they have. So they might continue contributing into the government super, but you can pull that out, you know, every month if you want to and roll it into your self-managed super fund.
Okay. Can I buy a residential property in super and live in it?
I love this question. It's easy because no, never, ever, ever. And neither can any of your family as well.
Okay. Now, that changes, though, with commercial.
Absolutely. So with commercial property, if you own a commercial property in your name at the moment, you can even have your self-managed super fund buy that from you. A self-managed super fund can buy commercial property. And, I mean, the problem with the residential is only if you want to live in it. Self-managed super funds can buy residential properties with no problems. You just can't live in it and you can't have any of your family or associates live in it.
Right. And so one thing that a few students have done recently is they've bought a residential property in their super fund as land banking,
mm-hmm.
and then sold it to themselves. Can they do that?
Absolutely can. Self-managed super funds are allowed to run a business. So that means they can buy land, they can spend the cost to get a DA. If there's borrowing on it, they can't do the subdivision if there's borrowing on it, but they can sell it to either themselves or one of their trusts outside of self-managed.
So let's just give a broad example. Yeah. I am doing a few property developments right now. Can't do the deal that I can. I found a deal and I really want to do it, but I don't have the funds right now because I've got other stuff going on. I use my super fund to purchase that deal.
Yep.
It might be a block of units or whatever that I could put on there, but at the moment it's a single house. My super fund purchases it. My super fund goes and gets the approval for the units to be put up, but because it's in a super fund residentially, I can't create more titles.
That's right.
Yeah. So when it gets to the point where the approval happens that I can put the units up, I can then go and purchase that property from my super fund.
Yes.
At market value.
And that's the important part to note. It has to be at market value. It has to be at arm's length. You know, we're not trying to do anything dodgy here. We're not trying to rip our own self-managed super fund off. If it's the same price, you'd sell it to someone outside. There's no issue whatsoever.
Okay, I've got a couple of questions here that probably Tash and Dipna can answer. In New South Wales, if you buy a PPR in a company trust structure, you lose the benefit of the purchase being capital gains tax-free when you sell. Why would you buy your PPR in a company trust in New South Wales? Also, if you're in New South Wales and your PPR is in company trust, you pay land tax from $1. This can cost you many thousands of dollars. Our accountant said, no, don't do it. Just buy the PPR in your personal name. Your thoughts?
Okay, let me answer that one there. First of all, you're talking about New South Wales, New South Wales, New South Wales. All that stuff is federal. So capital gains tax is federal. It's not something that changes from state to state. I don't say put your PPR in a trust necessarily. Now, here's the thing. I mean, you can do it if you do a long-term lease and still be able to avoid the capital gains tax by breaking the lease, and that's a capital payment. And I do go through that at the seminars. But every other property, all of the investment properties and everything, you're going to pay capital gains tax anyway. So, hey, let's protect it and put it into trust structures. The PPR is different because it does have that capital gains tax exemption in your own name. And unless you want to go down the line of having a long-term lease and that particular strategy, then really, you know, keep it in your own names and protect it in other ways. We talk about protection through debt. We talk about protection through insurances. We talk about protection through something called a contract of will. Now, this is all stuff that we go through in a lot of detail at the Ultimate event. So maybe, Zoe, you haven't quite been to an Ultimate event yet, but we certainly go through all of that stuff when you get there. So don't fret about it. In this case, I actually agree with your accountant for the PPR, not for everything else. And as for land tax is definitely state-based. And, yes, you do pay more by having properties, not your PPR, but other properties, in a trust rather than if you're in your own name for the first one or two. After that, it actually makes no difference because once you've got them, a number of them, you're going to be paying land tax anyway. And in some states, like Queensland as an example, you actually save land tax. So you don't end up paying, as much land tax because each one is quarantined in its own structure. So, you know, it really depends on the state-by-state basis there. And Zoe, don't worry about the PPR. I'm talking mainly about the other properties. And, I'll see you at the next boot camp because it's probably stuff that we need to go through with you at the boot camp. So I do go through all that stuff in a great deal of detail at the Ultimate event.
I have a couple of questions here. Can you buy, renovate, sell within self-managed super fund, renovate with super money, not borrowings? Is it then classified business or real estate?
Yep. So a lot of the restrictions in self-managed super fund are around when there's borrowings. If you want to buy, renovate and sell without borrowing any money, there is no problem whatsoever within a self-managed super fund. When it's classified as the business of real estate, it's really going to come down to that transaction and what your intention was. If your intention was to make a profit, then you are in the business of real estate within your self-managed super fund.
What's the tax if you were not in the business of real estate or in the business of real estate in the super fund?
Yeah, so with a super fund, if it's capital gains tax, it's 10% tax basically on the end. If you're in the business of real estate, it's 15%. So
you're talking 5% difference. So it's not a huge amount. What is the standard setup fee of a self-managed super fund and standard annual fees for tax return and audits, advisory fees, etc.?
Yeah, so we charge around $2,000 to set up a self-managed super fund, and we also strongly advise people to get financial advice. So that's around another $1,000. So our standard setup's about $3,300. Ongoing costs, that really relates to, I guess, what's in your self-managed super fund. I guess on average, if you're looking, probably around the $2,000 each year, and that actually includes the audit in that as well.
There is some questions here about rolling over from the UK pension into the self-managed super fund and how young is too young or how old is too old. I think probably for those questions, you're best to actually speak to the Investor Accounting Network direct rather than I'm going out here. Okay, let's move on here. Common questions when it comes to the corporate trustee and the trust as far as, the ACNs, ABNs, tax file numbers. Can you just break that down?
Absolutely. So a lot of people get confused as to what the ACN and the ABN number. An ACN is an Australian company number, and that's given to you when you incorporate a company. It has nothing to do with the ATO. It's just an identifying number for that company. When you set this up with the ATO, we're actually getting tax file number and ABN if required in the trust, not in the company. The company should never have a tax file number, and therefore it should never have an ABN, and it should never do a tax return. It's always done through the trust.
Cost of setting up these structures for asset protection?
Yeah, they're around $2,000 for those.
Yeah, and really you're in alignment with Pacific Law, and you all work together and you all know each other's deeds and trusts and stuff.
Absolutely. Kelvin's my lawyer, so,
Now,
Kelvin's everybody's lawyer.
He's everybody's lawyer.
I didn't plan on everybody sharing Kelvin.
You're not even grey.
Yes, he is.
You're not even bald.
This is a pick on Calvin. There's lots of me to go around, so it is fine.
Now, this is a question for both of you, obviously, Derek and Tash. Someone go, which is a very standard thing I've seen happen, and I don't want you to do this, but all of a sudden there's a property has been negotiated and you need a trust yesterday.
Yeah.
How quickly, worst case scenario, Can you set them up?
I can't do one for yesterday.
Can't do one for yesterday.
No. That's true. It can't be done for yesterday. We can move very quickly with these things. When they're urgent, they can be done in a matter of hours. Yesterday is a question we get asked from time to time. But you can't. you cannot set up a structure yesterday.
That's another question, Calvin, that we didn't speak about. You know, as people have been used to the and or nominee clause for many years past, and there is danger under the Office of State Revenue for some states that if you put a name on a contract and not correctly.
Yeah, that's right, Ian. And maybe sometimes the people from Victoria, because they can do that and not incur the double duty, but in every other state, if you have an and or nominee in the contract and you choose to exercise the nominee before the settlement, you are going to incur double duty.
Yeah, and that's dangerous. Now, who wants to pay two stamp duties?
Well, it's not so much dangerous. It's more the fact that you probably don't want to do it. I'm sure the states are very happy for you to do it.
Absolutely. More money in their coffers.
Yeah.
Okay. So Investor Accounting Network is across the country.
Yes.
Do you want to talk through on these ones?
Yeah, so we now have offices in Queensland, New South Wales, Victoria, and WA. The accountants we have in the States were picked because not only, I guess, of their knowledge, most of them have been working in the field at least 10 or 15 years, but they also have a personal passion for property as well, which I think is really, really important when you're dealing with professionals. You want to know that they're interested in the area that you are.
And they've all been through the education. They all know the stuff. They all know what we talk about.
Absolutely.
They all speak different, huh?
Yep.
Okay.
We all watch YouTube and read tax rulings at night for fun. So.
Okay, a couple of questions. One here for you, Tash. We have a house in a mining town that we may need to sell in the coming years as a potential loss. This property is owned in a trust structure. Can we do a development in the same structure that owns this property in a bid to offset the potential capital loss with a capital gain? Do we need to incur the loss and gain in the same financial year? Will the sell down of the development actually be classified as a capital gain or income tax?
Wow, a few questions in there. So I'm going to presume it's a capital gain without knowing the full details about that transaction. So they're going to
lose capital in selling down on the mining property.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
So then they're going to go off and do a development and make a gain.
Make a loss. Oh,
so make a loss. So in the future, they're going to do a development in the same trust. Yep. Which is going to make a gain?
Yep. I mean, my first comment on that is, I guess, with the asset protection and does it need to be in that trust? And I'm sure Derek or Kelvin can comment about that aspect.
Well, the mining town one, I think I know that the property is not a development. It's just a purchase that they purchased, so they haven't done any work to that mining town property.
Yeah, the issue is that Tash is alluding to is whatever asset you acquire in that trust in the future will be exposed to whatever past risk it's incurred. So from the legal perspective and an asset protection perspective, you look at whether it in fact is a good idea to have another asset in that structure, whether there's any past risks that are going to contaminate it into the future.
And I guess from a tax point of view, the reason that it's important is that a capital loss will carry forward forever in that structure. But if you have a capital gain in a different structure, you can distribute that capital gain into this trust with a loss.
You go and set up another structure. Jeez, I've got feedback there. Go set up another structure, make a capital gain in that structure and distribute the gain across to the mining town structure loss.
Absolutely.
And the mining town structure would be empty, but it's still holding the loss.
Absolutely. So you're not going to lose that loss. So that question that Derek was talking about is an important consideration.
So will the sell down of the development be classed as a capital gain or income tax?
I don't know that.
It'll depend on the person.
Yeah.
So it'll depend on the person and what you'll do and whether you're in the business of property and everything that goes with that.
Capital losses only can be applied against a capital gain.
So in the trust, which means that, you know, it depends on you as a person too on the distributions. I would like to receive advice on how to structure my development trust and I will be employed by this trust. Can the Investor Accounting Network help me based on their personal situation?
I would certainly hope so.
Yeah. with the three generation rules, Derek, does it work differently if you aren't married to your partner? Presumably they're listed as a beneficiary though.
The same rules apply. Basically a trustee defines a spouse or may define a spouse But it's not tied to marriage. Obviously, in this modern world, it's not always the case that people are married.
Yep. So it does include them. Includes if they're a spouse.
De facto spouses. It might include your spouse and your de facto spouse if you had more than one.
Yep. Is it better to have you both and your spouse as beneficiaries or just you to simplify the documentation? Now, I'll add here that with most of our structures now, I don't need to have Christine on the structures, so I only put myself on.
Yeah, that's the issue initially, that whoever we name specifically as a primary beneficiary may be asked to provide guarantees for borrowings. It's probably more likely than not. So if we're from a risk point of view, if we can identify one of you to pick on, we pick on that person, and if we can protect somebody, we do. The beneficiaries don't sign the document. So this question refers to simplifying document execution. Beneficiaries of a trust don't necessarily sign the document itself. It's the settlor and the trustee that signs the document.
So the simplicity of why I put only myself on our current is because I earn enough money on my own to be able to service loans on my own. I'm considered the one to be picked on in the relationship.
We're picking on you because of your income, which means that you're providing the serviceability for the trust. And if your serviceability is sufficient, we just have you. And sometimes the banks say, no, that's not enough. We want both of the spouses on there to provide that serviceability. And basically whatever the banks want, they get.
Sure.
Because there's no point in having a great asset protection vehicle that can't do anything because it hasn't got any money.
In which case, in a couple, the risky one would have everything in the portfolio in their name, and maybe the PPR would go in the other one's name.
Precisely.
Yeah, all right. A comment here. Great ideas, guys. 5 people on the webinar, very informative evening, like sitting around the dinner table talking to friends. Well, it's different than being around the dinner table with family. I'm in the process of buying an investment property. I've paid the deposit. Is it too late to put it in a trust, Calvin? So they've obviously bought a property already in their own name, and they want to put it into a trust, but it hasn't settled yet.
Look, it may be possible, and depends how far down the contract you are. It may be possible to negotiate a position where you can put in an alternate entity to purchase the property. But again, we'll need to work in with the vendor to do so.
It also, the question, sorry to interrupt, refers specifically to paying the deposit. And one of the important things with these sorts of questions is to actually work out where literally the contract is up to, because somebody may have paid a deposit but not signed a contract. A contract may not have been submitted yet.
And also what state.
Exactly.
Yeah, so around Australia, that's why Pacific Law has contacts all over the country and offices all over the country, in parts of the country as well. If you move to another state, will that change which accountant you have used in the past for the investor accounting network?
Absolutely not, unless you want it to, of course.
No, if you want to, you can change, but otherwise, if you're happy, like Tash said from the beginning, it's easy to be able to do things via, you know, with the internet. It's easy to do. There is a question here about, and I know that it's coming in on the next Q&A, about the bank equity trust. I do believe it's a Chan and Naylor trust, and Tasha doesn't know it yet, but she's going to find out what it's all about and tell me about it.
I can tell you.
Oh, actually, Dempner's already on it.
Look, it's just a fancy name that they've given what we've been doing for years. What it is you're using one of your trusts to take a mortgage over another property. Now, that's all it is. And, you know, if the situation is right, it's one of those things where, you know, remember what I tell you, you know, every time you've got an opportunity to move money, this is where you should go and talk to the accountant and say, okay, how can I use this movement of money to protect my existing asset? And that's one of the things that you might do. You might move it through another trust that you kind of set up as your own little merchant bank. I mean, you've heard me say that before. And that's exactly what you do. My issue here is that if the money doesn't physically move, I don't think it stands up. What about you, Derek?
No, the money has to actually change hands. There has to be a literal transfer of money for that sort of transaction to be real. And the way that this question describes the use of this product, it's exactly the same as the concept of the piggy bank trust. It's important how you put it into practice.
That's correct. And the other thing is, if you're not physically moving the money, then it's a variation of the other thing that we discussed, which is a contract of will.
That's right, which also has to be documented properly to make sure it's all legitimate and will stand up to scrutiny.
Yeah. So it's just a fancy name for the stuff that I've been teaching for years.
Okay. So if you don't need to meet people face-to-face, when is the IAN coming to Hobart? Well, we don't have to see you face-to-face, do you, Tasha?
No.
So give Tasha a call tomorrow and or one of the officers, and they can help you out. The Melbourne office is probably closer to you, but it really doesn't matter in the end. So you're from Hobart. Not many people speak Dimpna down here. I get some funny looks when I'm talking about everything. Backup needed.
I'm going down there at Christmas, but not necessarily
not
as
for accounting, right. Okay, so contact them tomorrow. The details are still on your screen there so that you can talk to them. Is a trust necessary if you already have a company? What are the benefits? Well, let me break this question up a bit. Some people already have a company that they've traded out of, and they then want to put a trust underneath that company. Is that a good idea, Tash?
No, absolutely not. And it comes back to what Derek was talking about before, and what have you already done in that structure, and do you want whatever risk you created in that structure to tarnish your brand new pretty trust?
Yeah, and that company also has got liabilities in the past. It's traded, yeah. It's done all these things, and depending on the company, but most of the time it's done stuff, and you want a brand new off-the-shelf company.
Absolutely.
So what are the benefits of a trust compared to buying in a company when it comes to property?
Yeah, so a trust has some pretty good features around sharing of the profit. So with a company, if a company makes a profit, it pays tax on it, and then really there's very few ways to get the money out of a company except for dividends and wages and that sort of thing. Companies are very strict. You can't just go and pull a whole stack of money out of a company bank account to go pay for your groceries on the weekend. Now, the ATO takes a pretty dim view of that and comes into what we call Division 7A. The ATO expects you to have a loan agreement, expects you to pay that money back to a company, and if it's not paid back, it has to be paid back with interest on top of it. And if you don't make those repayments, it will deem it as income to you anyway. Trusts are a completely different vehicle for tax. They don't pay tax themselves. So what a trust does is it will have a profit at the end of the year, and then we have to decide who we're going to distribute that profit to.
Now, if you don't distribute the profit, it does get taxed, though.
It does, but I can't say I've ever done that in my entire life.
Yeah, so just remember that you do have to do a distribution.
Absolutely.
So with buying property in a company, there's obviously the asset protection issue that goes with that because you're a director of that company, and there's also a capital gains issue. You're 100% capital gain.
That's right.
Whereas in a trust, you've got an exemption after 12 months.
That's right.
And
yeah.
One day.
And, you know, that's not saying companies don't have their place, because they absolutely do once your tax rate gets to a level where you're paying over 30 cents in a dollar. But depending on your situation, often trusts are a way to pay less tax.
Okay. Is there a replay of tonight's webinar? This webinar is recorded and it should be up on the website by within the week. We send it to Knowledge Source and they put it up for us. People want us to come to Launceston. Can you join two people super in a super self-managed super fund?
Yes, you can actually join up to four people into a self-managed super fund.
Do they have to be family?
No, they don't.
So they can be four unrelated parties. They can be related. It can be anyone.
Absolutely.
Right. Dimpna, I'm joining my super fund with yours.
like hell.
thank guys, Q&A was great. Okay, I've bought a last question, I think, because we're about an hour 15 now. I have bought a property in a trust with intention of doing a development. Should I create another trustee company and trust structure to undertake the development? If so, what is the relationship between property trust and development trust?
Probably a very specific question. We need to look at what the details of that are.
Likely, the most general thing about this is that you buy it in a corporate trustee and trust.
Yep.
You do the development within that trust, and then the decisions from there. You know, but again, it'll come down to each deal and and that's where you start getting advice from people as well. Okay, thanks guys. we've all had a good time. I've been watching. I don't drink. I've been watching these guys drink. They've drunk three bottles of wine between
us.
Maybe not. No, they've been very good. So
thanks, guys. We shall catch you again next time. We'll be back in a fortnight. So send in any of the questions, anything that we didn't get answered tonight or you want answered on the next Q&A, get the questions in via email at questions@realestatesuccess.com.au. Send them in by 4 o'clock Queensland time on the Monday. So anytime before that, we collate them. And then 4 o'clock Queensland time to make sure that we've got them. And then my PA, Sophie, she puts them all together and emails them to us, and we can go through and make that happen. So catch you again, guys. We'll see you in a couple of weeks' time. And for those who are in Adelaide, we shall see you in 2 days' time.
Very excited.
Which will be fabulous.
All right. See you, guys.
Bye.
Bye.